chapter 14. Verse 8. Let's do a prayer. Om Parataya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Yasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Nitavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvaishini. Verse 8.
Tamastvajnanajam viddhi
Mohanam sarvadehinam Mohanam sarvadehinam Pramadalasya nidrabhi Tanibhadnati bharata Tamaha, tamas, tu, ajnanajam, vidhi, Mohanam, sarva, dehinam, Pramada, alasya, nidrabhihi, tan, nipadnati, bharata. Remember the verse 6 and 7 went through the nature of sattva, and how sattva binds, and then rajas, and how rajas binds. So the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas of maya. So sattva is that principle that reflects consciousness, that allows for ananda to manifest in the mind. Light, luminosity, that's all sattva. The mind and the sense organs that enjoy consciousness are made of sattva. Rajas is that active principle, like the prana, the karmendriyas, the organs of action, that's all born of rajas. Agitation in the mind is rajas. A desire, the desire that impels one to act is rajas. Tamas is that principle kind of born of ajnanam. And so here we're going to look at tamas. This is where we left off last time. So tamaha tu, whereas tamas, may you know, vidhi, that tamas, which is ajnanajam, born of ajnanam, it itself is mohanam, delusion. It brings about that mohanam for all beings. We'll see what that means in a minute. That tamas, born of ajnanam, may you know that tamas, born of ajnanam, to be mohanam, the delusion that all beings suffer from. It is that tamas that binds a person, binds all beings, by means of pramada, alasya, and nidra. Pramada, pramada means that not doing what you know needs to be done. What you must do, what you should do, what you're supposed to do, you don't do. That's pramada. You basically, it's kind of like blowing it off. You know it needs to be done, but you ignore it and you don't do it. That's pramada. Alasya is a little different than that. Alasya is a lack of an inertia, a lack of any type of will or energy to even do the things you want to do. Say you have some sort of a desire, some sort of little ambition is there. There's no energy to do it. And so it's a slothfulness is alasya. Nidra is sleep. So a person who, everybody needs sleep, but you can use sleep as an escape, where instead of living your life, you're sleeping away your life. That's nidra. So these get more and more slothful. So the pramada is, I simply don't do what I know I need to do. It's blowing it off. blowing off my responsibilities and doing. I just don't care. I don't have the energy. Alessia is that slothfulness. But even the things I might want to do, I don't care. I don't have the energy to do it. Nidra is oversleeping. So this tamas, now he says the tamas, which is ajnanajam. Ajnanam here, there's two types of ajnanam. Ajnanam is a big word in Vedanta because we say self-ignorance. That type of ajnanam, when we say ajnanam, we're talking about the self-ignorance, the ignorance of one's own being, the ignorance of the Atma, the ignorance removing which is self-knowledge. That's called mula avidya, or mula ajnanam. Mula means root. So it's the ajnanam that all beings suffer from. The ajnanam is that is there backing sattva, rajas, and tamas and is actually causal to it. That's mula ajnanam. Here, this ajnanam is not mula ajnanam. It's called tula. Tulyajnanam. What that means is it's the ajnanam or ignorance in reference to dharma and adharma. The ignorance in terms of vyavahara in empirical reality. I don't know what is right. I don't know what is wrong. That viveka in terms of proper behavior, proper action, proper values is not there. And so here he's saying the tamas, which is ajnanajam, born of this type of ajnana, may you know that that brings about moha, mohana, which is a delusional. For all beings, that type of tamas will bring about that because you don't see clearly. It's a very simple. Another way of understanding this type of delusion, when you're not able to differentiate or see clearly what is actually going on in the world that you're experiencing, that allows you to project all kinds of realities on it. That's what we call projection. Projection is so interesting. There's what we call Ishwara Srishti, Ishwara's creation, what is actually happening in the creation, and then what your mind projects upon it. If what your mind projects upon it is not, which we call Jiva Srishti, is not true to what is actually there, then mind is delusional. That's a delusion. Right? If I can say, if I see a snake on a rope, the snake is a delusion. There is no snake there. There's only a rope. If I project intentions or motives onto another person, and it's not true to the actual intent of that person, that's a projection. It's delusional. It's not happening at all. In fact, in psychology, we say the whole process of psychology is to withdraw delusion after delusion after delusion. Complexes are delusions. In the sense of the complex is something that I'm carrying inside, which because of a certain action or a certain trigger in the external world, it excites that complex, and then I see, whatever I'm seeing through the lens of that complex. And it's all completely real. What makes it so delusional is that there's no one inside saying this is a delusion. You know, the person inside believes that what is being experienced is absolutely true. And it's very shocking if you're able to really talk with the other person and you trust what they have to say, to recognize that what you had so strongly felt, what you had so strongly believed, is not at all what was happening. It's absolutely shocking. One of the reasons it's shocking is because for us, our emotions are more real than our thoughts. Because the emotions are pervasive, they last longer, and your thinking takes place within the emotions. So for instance, I can be feeling, say for instance, I'm feeling very, very down, very, very sad. That sadness remains as though, for the time, as long as it's there, it remains as a constant. Right? And then your thinking is taking place within that constant. And so all of the type of thoughts that you have are in relation to the emotion. See what I mean? So you're having lots of thoughts, but those thoughts are all taking place within the emotion of sadness. And it's through the emotion of sadness also that I'm looking out at the world. And so now all of my interpretations are going to be through that emotion of sadness. It's very interesting. Because when you get out of the emotion or get out of the complex, then the world that you had been experiencing is negated. Just like the snake is negated when you see the rope. And so here, when there's Ajnanajam, you can say the Ajnanajam, born of Ajnanam. You can say Swamiji talks about it in terms of your inability to know what is correct or what is right or wrong. It also means the total, it's an aviveka. It's a lack of discrimination, really, between the objective reality that you're experiencing on the one level and the emotional reality that you're superimposing on it. And you tend to go with the what is being superimposed. That's where your shraddha is. The shraddha is in the jiva srishti, not in the ishvara srishti. As you get used to these type of the tamas and these complexes that overwhelm one's experience, you can start to gain a little window, just a little voice, a little piece of consciousness inside that can say to you, I know I completely believe this to be true, but it still could be a complex. That's a big thing to be able to say, because what you're saying is, even though I'm positive, I'm absolutely convinced that this is true, I know that it's true, nevertheless, it could be a complex. That's a big thing to be saying, because when the complex is taking over, when the complex is manifest, part of, what do you call it, the symptom of that complex is that, if it is a complex, the symptom of it is that it is absolutely real to you. And so it's only through your training, through your knowledge, that can allow you to say that, you know, when complexes occur, they do seem absolutely real. This does seem absolutely real. And so therefore it still could be a complex. It's just a little piece of knowledge that allows you to come into relationship with it rather than taking it to be real. This is the Ajnanajam. So this tamas, born of Ajnanam, like this lack of any type of viveka between what is actually real and what is being superimposed, so they don't have any clarity in terms of what's really going on, that's Mohanam. What's interesting here is that all beings have this. It's not that only some beings suffer from tamas. This, as we'll see later, the sattva, rajas, and tamas are there as the three gunas, and sometimes for every being, you're going to be overwhelmed by tamas. Sometimes you're overwhelmed by sattva, and that's more enjoyable. Sometimes the rajas is in the lead. That gives you a lot more energy and the ability to pursue, but you haven't lost dharma and adharma. You have the ability to pursue, to seek happiness. That's rajas. Tamas, all of that is gone. You're overwhelmed. You're just kind of overwhelmed by slothfulness, overwhelmed by not knowing what to do. Total lack of clarity that we call mohanam. So that's when tamas is predominant. And so when the tamas is predominant, then the person is bound by this pramada. You have no energy to do what is to be done. Also, you have no rajas. You don't have the means to pursue your desires. You become kind of a little bit catatonic. You can't do, that's an extreme word, but you can't perform. You don't have the energy to do that. And all you want to do is sleep. So this tamas, when tamas is on the top, you know, that's the condition that a person can find themselves in. So now he's gone through sattva, rajas, and tamas in terms of mental states. That's what we've done. So now he's going to kind of talk about it, summarize it, and then go on and talk about it a little bit differently. So let's go on to that, verse 9. Sattvam sukhe sanjayati. Sattvam sukhe sanjayati. Rajak karmani bharata. Rajak karmani bharata. Jnanam avrityatu tamaha. Jnanam avrityatu tamaha. Pramade sanjayatyuta. Pramade sanjayatyuta. Sattvam sukhe sanjayati. Rajaha karmani bharata. Jnanam avritya tu tamaha. Pramade sanjayati uta. He says, just summarizing, sattva, the sattva guna, it binds in the form of sukha. When the mind is in, has a shantavritti, when the mind is relaxed, the mind is calm, there's no agitation there, there's no slothfulness there. That state of mind reflects the ananda, the wholeness of one's being. So whenever the sattva rises, one feels whole, one feels complete, one feels full, one feels happy. And that is a desirable condition. And so that desirable condition of feeling whole and complete, I'm attached to. And so what that means then is, in terms of my emotional, mental experiences, there are certain states of experience that I work for, that I want to keep. So say, those times when, say, you fulfilled a desire, or you're with a loved one, or you're walking in nature, whatever it is that allows you to have that shanti, where you're feeling all is well with me, then this is what I want. That this is what I want is what is binding. I want this. I want to feel like this, you know. But the feeling like this is really the feeling of a vritti that is going to pass. And so that vritti, that thought modification, which happens to be peaceful, right, is always compared to the thought modifications that are not peaceful. The agitated thought modifications or the tamasic thought modifications. So of the agitated, angry, distressed thought modifications, and among those, and among the tamasic ones, of the sattvic ones, the ones that are that reflect ananda, which ones do I want? The ones that I want are the ones that allow me to feel whole. And so when I have those type of thoughts, I have an attachment to them. And a fear of having the other kind. And so the sattva itself, the sattva guna of the mind, when the sattva is predominant, I'm bound by my desire to have that type of a thought versus more rajas thoughts or more tamasic thoughts. So the sattva binds us in the form of sukha, happiness, ananda. The rajas binds us, sanjayate, so rajas, this verb goes with all of them. Rajas binds us in the form of karma, because the rajas is what, as we'll see in a little bit more detail in a minute, the rajas is what impels me into action. It's really what allows for desire. I want this. I need this. You know, I have a desire for this. I have a longing for this. That longing is what impels me into action. I just can't sit and relax. Right? Because my mind is wanting something, and it'll circle around that desire, you know, until I fulfill it. And so the rajas is not very comfortable. I can't sit and relax with rajas. I can sit, and my body can sit still, but my mind is going to be whirling around that desire, trying to figure out how to get it. Okay, so rajas binds in that it impels me into action. My mind can't just sit and relax with what is and enjoy with what is. Then he says, and now the tamas, he says, jnanam avritya tu tamaha. He says, and the tamas, having covered jnanam, having the, having covered the jnana, the viveka jnana, that ability to discriminate between what is right and wrong, and between the jiva srishti and Ishwara srishti, Ishwara's creation and the jiva's projection upon it, the inability to discriminate, the inability to choose right action or even discriminate between dharma and adharma. So having covered that jnana, that tamas binds by means of, in the form of pramada. Pramada is where I know it needs to be done, but I don't do it. It's not that I don't know, but I don't have the wherewithal to do it. I can even, the tamasic attitude is I don't even care. I know what I need to do. I don't care. I'm not going to do it. That's the tamas. It's a very slothful, kind of a dark, heavy energy that doesn't allow you to do what needs to be done. So here he's just repeating these three and making you get more of a feel for them. So now let's go to the next one. All of these are just circling around the same thing. Rajas tamas cha bhibhuya
sattvam pavati bharata.
Sattvam pavati bharata. Rajas sattvam tamas chaiva. Rajas sattvam tamas chaiva. Tamas sattvam rajas tata. Tamas sattvam rajas tata. Rajas tamas cha abhibhuya sattvam bhavati bharata. Rajaha sattvam tamaha cha chaiva eva. Rajas sattvam tamas cha eva. Tamas sattvam rajas tata. He says here is, remember, rajas sattva and the sattva, rajas and tamas, these three gunas, they are maya. It's not that maya has three gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. Maya is these three gunas. And so that means on every level of this manifest creation, there is a continual play of rajas, sattva, and tamas. And so he's really dealing with this play of sattva, rajas, and tamas in reference to your mind, to the buddhi, to the antakarana. And so, because we can look at rajas, sattva, and tamas in reference to the creation, you know, or in reference to any aspect that we experience in the creation, it's all sattva, rajas, and tamas. And so here now, it's being really, all of this discussion is being really used in reference to the mind, the mind which is overpowered by rajas, the mind which is overpowered by tamas, etc. So here he's saying this. Rajaha tamaha cha abhibhuya sattvam bhavati. Having overpowered abhibhuya, the rajas and the tamas, sattva rises. Because there are these three, it's an interplay between all three. So sattva rises to the top, means becomes dominant, when it over, having overpowered the rajas and the sattva. The rajas and the tamas kind of get overpowered, overwhelmed, and sink down, right? Sink down into unconsciousness, in a sense. They're not, they become totally overpowered by the strength of sattva. And then when that's so, then your mind seems very sattvic. You know, rajas and tamas have been overpowered, and so at that time the mind is light. It enjoys ananda. It's full of numinosity, full of bright energy, full of shining knowledge. Okay? That's sattva, when it's having overpowered rajas and tamas. And then rajas similarly overpowers sattva and tamas. And when rajas arises, comes to the forefront, then all of its qualities, as we'll see in a minute, such as greed, etc., all of these qualities are what are taking place in the mind. And then at another time, tamas overpowers the sattva and the rajas. And at that time, this slothfulness and pramada and sleeping all of the time is what overpowers. So earlier on, and again, Krishna is going to say things like, when you're having these different types of experiences in the mind, recognize them as my prakriti. Recognize these experiences that you're having as manifestations of sattva, manifestations of rajas, manifestations of tamas. Don't identify them with the atma. That's the idea. You're having all of these different types of vrittis. Some vrittis, some thought modifications are so enjoyable to you. You feel so whole and complete and strong, you know, together. Those are so say, oh, my mind is really enjoying sattva at this time. And at other times you have a lot of energy, a lot of, you know, wanting, a lot of desire, even a lot of greed, a lot of miserliness, where you really, you know, have a lot of energy that's built up around your desire. And then at that time you can say, oh, my mind is really rajas. This is really rajasic. But what all you're doing is recognizing quality of the mind belonging to the prakriti, of belonging to maya, not to yourself. All of these are gunas or qualities of the gunas that belong to the prakriti, not to the atma. It's just a tool for having that viveka. Oh, I can't believe how just dull, all I want to do is sleep, or I just don't even care about anything. Okay, it's tamas. The tamas guna is what is predominant at this time. You know, once you kind of label it like that, if you're doing this type of labeling, you're doing it for the sake of viveka, discriminating your own being, discriminating your being, the atma, from these particular types of states that sattva, rajas, and tamas manifest when they're dominant. This is how they manifest. And so, in a way, it's just another device to help you to not identify with different states of qualities of mind and to bring you back to the recognition of yourself. Okay? So now, having said that, that when sattva is predominant or when rajas is predominant or tamas is predominant, now he's going to go through each of these three, okay, to tell you what it's like. The first one is what it's like when the sattva is predominant. So he goes, Sarva-dvare-shu-dehe-smin, prakasha-upajayate, jnanam-yadatada-vidyat, jnanam-yadatada-vidyat, vivriddham-sattva-ityuta, sarva-dvare-shu-dehe-asmin, prakashaha upajayate, jnanam yada tada vidyat, vivriddham sattvam iti uta. He's describing sattva now. He says, sarvadvareshu dehe asmin. In this body, in all of this, all of sarvadvara means all of the doors, all of the sense organs. When in this body, in all of the sense organs, prakashaha upajayate, prakasha is born, means your sense organs are lit up. They're shining. He says, so when jnanam, when knowledge is prakasha, is luminous. It's okay, Tibby. It's okay. Go get some dinner. You're okay. Sarvadvareshu dehesmin prakashaha upajayate jnanam yada. So he says, this prakasha, which is jnanam, this prakasha, which is jnanam, is born. When that is born, when that is shining in all of the sense organs in this body, then he says, may you know that the sattva is something which has increased, has become strong. So to understand, when the mind is sattva, is sattvic, then there's clarity. Even when you're looking, when you're talking, when you're engaged, when you're thinking, there's clarity because the mind is bright and it's still and it's focused, right? And so the mind, we say that is jnanam, it's the buddhi, right? Because there's clarity there. The mind isn't wavering. And so the mind is shining with knowledge. So he says, in all of the sense organs in this body, this jnanam is prakashaha, is lit up. Why do they say jnanam? Your mind, your thoughts are, every thought that you have really is illumined, right? But what could be illumined is just emotion or slothfulness or agitation. That's where the focus is. But when all of that is gone, when the sattva is coming into manifestation, is strong, then at that time, what is shining is just your knowledge. Like right now, say that your mind, just to make it a little more clear, say your mind is relaxed and quiet right now, and you have your sense organs open, then the perception that you're having through your sense organs is what is there, what is being illumined. That's jnana, that's knowledge. Say, in terms of gaining self-knowledge, in terms of this pramana, the utilization of this pramana, the mind has sattva. It's predominantly sattva. When that's the case, the mind is just there, still. It's just there in a relaxed way, receiving, you know, receiving whatever the pramana has to give. There's no rajas, there's no tamas to be getting in the way. And so what's just taking place for you at that time when the mind is sattva, it's just knowledge. It's the, and we call that clarity. It's the clarity of knowledge. Nothing is coming to interfere because rajas and tamas have been overpowered. So what is vivriddha, what has become strong, is the sattva. So it says, when in all through all of the doors of knowledge, and through all of the doors means all of the sense organs or all of the pramanas in this body. When that jnanam is shining, we say the sattva, you know, that jnanam has arisen, then we say sattva, the jnanam, which is shining, prakasha, which is light, which is luminous. We say that at that time, may you know, vidyat, that the sattva itself is predominant, vivriddham, it has become strong. So let's look at the next one, let's look at rajas.
Lobhav pravrittirarambha, lobhav pravrittirarambha, karmanam ashamaspraha, karmanam ashamaspraha, rajasyetani jayante, rajasyetani jayante, vivriddhe paratarshaba, vivriddhe paratarshaba, lobhav pravrittihi, arambha karmanam ashamaha spraha rajasi etani jayante vivriddhe bharatarshava.
He says lobha means greed. I have the desire, I want what you can even be, I want what you have. Or I have a strong desire, lobha. It's often translated as greed. Pravrittihi means I have the energy. I have an inclination to pursue, to go after something. Is pravritti. Arambha karmanam. This lobha and this pravritti means I have an inclination to go after something. What this does is it arambha karmanam. It is what begins my actions, right? If you don't have this, you have lobha, you have a desire, lobha is a desire and a greed, and you have a pravritti, an inclination, both of these things impel me into action. They are what start, arambha means start. They are the start of actions. Without any pravritti, without any desire rising in the mind, there's nothing to make you act. So they are the beginning of, they are what begins one's karma, one's actions. Also, it's known as ashamaha. Shamaha, when the mind enjoys shama, the desires or the thoughts that take place in the mind simply pass through. That's shama. Your thoughts are just passing through. They're not creating any type of agitation. Ashamaha, that unnegates. Ashamaha means the thoughts are catching you. Instead of the thoughts passing through you, the thoughts catch you. And when a thought catches you, then all of your other thoughts are rotating around this one thought. It's as though, you know, a spider in a web type of thing. The thought is generating all kinds of other thoughts, and you can't let it go. You can try to let it go, but it doesn't go. Right? That's ashamaha. And spriha just means desire. Lobaha has more of the sense of greed, you know, greed and the kind of miserliness. Spriha has more of the sense of just simple desire, the desire for something. Pravritti means I have an inclination. So, say pravritti is not as much as spriha, as desire. Spriha is not as much as lobha, because lobha means greed. And also, with the greed can come selfishness, miserliness, not wanting to share, all of these type of things. This is all rajas. And all of these impel you to action. You can't sit still with them. So he says, rajasi vivriddhe, when this rajas is dominant, right, then all of these types of feelings arise. It can be lobha or spriha or pravritti. And all of these are initiating you into action. These are the types of attitudes, feelings, drives that arise when rajas is predominant. Okay. So let's do tamas. Aprakashe pravrittischa, aprakashe pravrittischa, pramado moha evacha, pramado moha evacha, tamasyetani jayante, tamasyetani jayante, vivriddhe kurunandana, vivriddhe kurunandana, aprakashaha, apravrittihi cha, pramadaha moha evacha. Tamasi etani jayante vivriddhe kurunandana. He says, now tamas. The aprakashaha. Aprakasha means light. Aprakashama prakashaha means the light's not there. It doesn't mean blackness, but it means dullness. There's not, the mind is not shining. It's not shining with light. It's not shining with knowledge. It's dark. It's dull. It's tired. You know, it's tamasic. That's so aprakashaha. And apravritti, pravritti means, would be rajas. It has energy. Pravritti means I have an inclination to do something. I want to go. I want to do something. In tamas, you don't have the energy or the desire to do anything. You're slothful. You'd rather just hang out or sit or lay on the couch or drink or whatever, you know. There's no energy to impel you into action. It's, you even have that pramada, where even when you know you should act, you have responsibilities and duties and dharma that needs to be done, you will blow it off. You don't want to do it and you just don't care. That's all tamas. And you know that that's expected and that you need to do it, but you don't do it. That's tamas. Moha, again, is that delusion caused by all of these projections, and not having the energy to do what needs to be done causes all kinds of projections and darkness in the mind. Even you notice it yourself when you don't do what you should do, or you don't do what you should do, or you do what you shouldn't do, these type of things. It actually causes a lot of consternation in your mind. Your mind can't rest when it's like that, you know. And so when that is the situation, that is a perfect situation for moha, for projection. Because in your not doing what you should have done, you will then project onto the other people how they feel. There's all kinds of projection that takes place in that type of situation. You're not doing what is you're supposed to do, and so that puts you in kind of almost a delusional state with everybody else in the situation. You have to just think about that in terms of your own experience. You can start blaming others or rationalizing your behavior. That's all delusional. You blame others, you rationalize your behavior, justify your behavior so that you don't have to face what you've done. And it's natural. Yeah. Because we don't want to have to take responsibility for wrong action. It takes a lot of courage in a way, you know, to actually take responsibility for your wrong actions. It's much easier to blame everybody else. But in the blaming of everybody else, that's delusional. You're justifying and rationalizing, you know, your behavior. You're justifying and rationalizing your behavior so you don't have to face it. And that's moha. Nobody's free of this. You have it in more or less degrees at given times in your life. So it's not like there's somebody who's free of this. No, this is I've never experienced this. Everybody's experienced it. Everybody knows what I'm talking about, and I know what I'm talking about also. So it's important to understand this type of stuff so that you can recognize it, you know, and then do something about it. In psychology and therapy, a lot of our task has to do with recognizing all of the shadow stuff, owning it up. You know, because if we're not able to own it up, we project it all out on others. The other person, it's what the other person did. Never what I did. What they say in Jungian psychology, which for me is important, whenever you find yourself blaming the other, that's just, it should be like a red light. You know, it's kind of like a red light that should be tapping you on your shoulder to then say, who am I in this situation? What is my part of this situation? It's always never one way. We learn, but this is a learning, to actually learn that, because otherwise your psyche deludes you. It's not like your ego is deluding you. Your psyche, your whole psyche, your defense system deludes you, because we don't want to suffer, and we don't want to be blamed, we don't want to be guilty. And so instead of feeling the guilt or feeling the shame of our actions, you know, we'll bring in a secondary defense that causes us to put all that blame and guilt onto the other person. And when we see ourselves, anytime we see ourselves doing that, we have to say, okay, wait a minute. What am I carrying here? What have I done here? Does any of this belong to me? And that's a very, very important inquiry. And Jung will say, the more you're able to own up your own shadow material, the more other people can relax around you. The more you can own up your own stuff, the more other people feel safe in your presence, because otherwise everyone else is having to carry your shadow material. And say for instance, if I project my shadow material on you, the things that I don't like about myself, but I can't deal with it, I project that on you, then I don't like you. instead of owning up what I don't like in myself, I project that onto you. It's all defense mechanism, and then I don't like you. And so when I don't like you because of that projection, right, then that person is not going to feel very safe being around you. So to the degree that you can do this work of owning up your own shadow, you're really withdrawing all this delusion. You know, you're the moha, you're withdrawing from the universe and really dealing with the problem where the problem is. Then the people in your world can feel safe because you're not projecting anything on them. And because you're able to deal with your own problems with some compassion and understanding. Now say, you won't bring this moha to yourself to own it if you're going to be mean toward yourself. You're not going to do that. The only way you can do that is if you learn how to be a friend to that part of yourself that is having these problems. If you can be a friend to yourself and to these limitations and to these weaknesses and guilts and whatnot that we have, if we can be a friend to ourselves, then everybody gets that, not just you. If I can be a friend to whatever weaknesses I have and try to help myself grow and help myself mature and to be supportive, if I can give that to myself, I can give it to you. If I can't give that to myself, I really can't give it to you. And if I can't give that to myself, not only can't I give it to you, I will project onto you what I can't handle about myself. And then I will go after you as the culprit. Because I'm not able to be with that darkness in myself. And so here is moha. This is all the darkness and confusion that tamas is able to cause. When rajas is active, rajas is more directed toward accomplishment and attaining happiness. And so I'm not admired so much in my complexes as I am with tamas. And sattva, at that time, the complexes are not active. Rajas is not even active. At that time, my mind is just bright with knowledge. You know, there's clarity. That's why we want, when we're gaining self-knowledge, we want to make sattva predominant. Because you can have sattva, rajas, or tamas predominant. When you're doing shravana, when you're in class, when you're studying, we want sattva to be predominant because knowledge is just flowing into the mind at that time. That's why when Swamiji, for instance, I think we all try to do this to the best of our ability, but he's a master of it. When he's teaching, he will do so many things to lighten up your mind, you know, to make you smile, to make you laugh, to make you roar with laughter, you know, and then roaring with laughter because he's so funny. He's such a good teller of stories, storyteller and teller of jokes. You're laughing so hard, and your mind is just in a place of lightness and clarity, full of tejas for that moment. And then he'll teach again, you know. Then he'll teach for a while, and then he'll tell another joke. Release all of the sattva, all of the rajas, release all of the rajas, all of the tamas. Make sattva become dominant. And then he'll teach some more. That's a master, because he's giving you the adhikaritvam. The teacher makes the mind into a qualified student for the time being, so that this pramana can do its job, this means of knowledge can do its job. It gets rid of the tamas and rajas for the time being, you know, and allows for this, creates a disposition in the mind where the mind is capable of seeing. Yeah. This is what we also do, all of the value of values and all of these things, what we're doing more and more, making sattva more predominant in contemplation when we do nididhyasana meditation. What we're doing, like when we do the inner child work and relaxation exercises, pranayama, these type of things, we're making sattva become predominant. We're appeasing the rajas. And we're taking care of some of the tamas, some of the complexes inside by holding them, by being kind. And then we're even working with our desires by offering them to Ishwar, not trying to thwart those desires, but giving them to Ishwar and accepting, you know, the results of your actions with that prasada buddhi to calm down the rajas. You know, not to get rid of desire, but to calm it down by giving the mind, okay, I want this, I'm going to go for it. I have this desire, but whatever Ishwara gives is fine with me. And that's that karma yoga buddhi. Yeah. It all creates that mind, which is predominantly sattva, which allows for knowledge to take place. See, so. But that's enough, I think. then the next verses we're going to go into how the sattva, rajas, and tamas, the predominance of sattva, rajas, and tamas will affect your next life. This chapter is the chapter of the gunas, the three gunas, so that's good enough for now. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Harihi Om.
I got a little confused with all these gunas flying around. I'm not sure who's responsible for them, or who created them, or...
Maya.
Who's...
Prakriti.
So it really doesn't have anything to do with me.
The self, your being, conscious being, is always free.
Yeah.
Of all three gunas.
Yeah.
Right? But your attitudes and whatnot can excite the gunas and also help to quieten them down. And one of the things is just to recognize it, to recognize these different types of moods in your mind. You know?
So am I responsible for these moods, or these moods come from Maya, and then where do I come into play as a...
Well, I think... If you want to take responsibility toward affecting them, it would be not so much in creating them, but in how you are with them when they arise. Like, say, for instance, if you're being pulled by rajas, the recognition of that, being pulled by rajas, allows you to come into relationship with it. Every time you come into relationship with it, then the buddhi has differentiated itself from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have a choice of how to be with that type, particular type of energy. It's not driving you. You've come in, your buddhi has come into relationship with it. It's the same with all of this tamas. You recognize this particular condition of your mind. Means when you recognize it, you come into relationship with it. The buddhi, once it comes into relationship with that, is free of it. It has a choice to how to be with that. And it's the same with sattva. Instead of taking your being, the buddhi taking itself, taking the atma to be the sattva vritti,
yeah,
that sattva modification, it comes into relationship with it.
Because I usually take myself to be whatever that quality of mind is.
Absolutely,
there.
But yeah, that's why if you give those, all of those different types of qualities to the sattva, rajas, and tamas,
mm-hmm,
you know, which is really responsible, which is going to be affecting at all times, really, and depending upon what is ever dominant, the quality of the vritti, once you come into relationship with it, you're free of it. Then you have distance, you have choice, you have space, you know, and you can act upon it. And then you also, the buddhi, once it does that, then there's viveka. The buddhi recognizes the atma, the self, right, the conscious being, and it also recognizes the gunas,
mm-hmm,
the qualities of mind. So that's the viveka. Once you do that, then if the buddhi has knowledge, self-knowledge, once you objectify the gunas, then you're differentiating those from your being.
But the inclination is to be involved with them, not to...
Well, it is until you know this. But if you're a mumukshu, you're trying to gain knowledge, right? Then even learning about this type of differentiation becomes meaningful. If the inclination is to get involved, that's where you have to learn how to pull your mind back. And also, it's a good time to bring in, where's your vairagya in reference to that? To what degree is this particular situation, necessary for your ananda? I need this in order to be whole and complete. That's a very painful state. That is samsara. Right there, that's what it is. I need this in order to be whole and complete. And that's what causes us pain and anxiety and anxiousness. That's the whole karma yoga buddhi actually is, I have a desire for this, but I accept the results of my actions as prasad. That prasada buddhi. Prasad, is what's given in the temple. So with that particular attitude, I'm free to pursue my desires rather than trying to thwart them. But I pursue them having an attitude where I go for the desire as long as it's within dharma, but I accept the results as prasad from the Lord, and that starts to thin out and neutralize, these desires. Because otherwise, instead of that karma yoga buddhi, what's the other alternative is, I need this in order to be happy, that's it. You actually don't need it. You don't need anything to be happy. The ananda is your own being. And nobody can take that away. You don't need anything at all. Ishwar can't even take that away from you. Nobody can take the ananda away from you. It is you. But our mind, because of beginningless ignorance, beginningless births, is totally conditioned to having to have things a particular way in order for you to be happy. Now, the tricky part about this is that, and as you gain nishta in your clarity, in your knowledge, desires for your whole life, whether you're a great Mahatma or Swamiji, or it doesn't matter who you are, the prarabdha karma is going to manifest in terms of your own personal desires that rise up from within you, or desires from other people who pull you into a situation, or just the situation that the universe gives you that has nothing really to do with desire. It's just the unfoldment of the universe puts you into a situation. This is how the prarabdha karma takes place. This is what impels action. Something has to impel action. But for you, if as you become rested in your knowledge, you may have desires propelling you into this action or that action, but there's not this, I have to have this so that I can be happy. So happily I can go along with these desires, and happily I can have those desires manifest or not manifest. That's freedom. If you think that, for me to be free or to be a wise person, and no, I can't have any desires, that actually is not a reality. Because desire is necessary in order for you to act, even to go get a glass of water. You have to have a desire. To go to school, to go to work, to do anything, you have to have a desire. Something has to impel you to do that action. That's what we call desire. That's why we say human being, first of all, you can't be free from desire, nor can you be free from karma. It's impossible. But the jnani is the one who is a sarva karma sannyasi. Means the one who has given up, who is totally free from all karma. The only one that is free from karma is yourself, the Atma. Right? The Atma is free from karma, it's free from desire, it's free from sattva, rajas, and tamas. And so the sattva karma sannyasi is the one who knows the self. The self is the sattva karma sannyasi, right? And so for you, desires can be rising in the mind, But they don't follow, the desires don't follow the desire template of the Ajnani, the one who doesn't have knowledge. The desire template of the Ajnani is, I want this so that I can be happy. That so that I can be happy part is the defining factor for the Ajnani. I want this, I need this so that I can be happy, so that I can be full, so that I can be pleased. So that I can be complete. That's a desire. But for a jnani, it's, I want this, but if I don't get it, that's fine. And that is as real as the other is for the ajnani. The reason the jnani can say, I want this, oh yeah, I want this, this would be great, but if I don't get it, that's fine. The reason that a jnani can say that with integrity is because the mind has Viveka has differentiated the source of the ananda from the world. The source of the ananda is the atma, which is never not there. And the mind is never not with the self. Right? And so there's no ananda at stake in reference to your fulfillment or non-fulfillment of a desire. And that is a person's reality as you know it, as you gain clarity in your knowledge. It's not just a head trip. It's that you've recognized the source, you know, you've recognized where the ananda is hiding. And you recognize it as your own being, and it's never not there. The wholeness of the atma of your being becomes what is in gestalt, what has come to the forefront. And so then the desires are fun and interesting. Your prarabdha, the karmas that caused you to take this birth, are interesting. It's yours. Nobody can take it away from you. This is your unique birth. And you have every right to it. The universe has, you have a place in this universe, which is your birth, that takes you from your birth to your death. This is yours. Nobody can take it away. Nobody can take your prarabdha karma away from you. So Swamiji will say, you know, if it's your prarabdha, you'll get it, and if it's not, you won't. It's easy. Simple.
Yeah. It seems like it would be appropriate to take that same attitude towards whatever guna is predominating. The fact that, well, now I'm experiencing tamas maybe, but I'd rather be sattvic in class or something like that.
Yeah.
But then also, once you recognize that there's a guna predominating, it seems like then there's a choice about what would be a skillful response.
Yeah.
Like there can be different ones. Like maybe when you're tired, sometimes if it's appropriate, you might want to just take a nap, and then, you know, that's the thing to do. But if
you
you're
have
driving
a choice.
A car, that's, you know.
And if you're driving a car, you might pull over the,
right.
the you know.
But
yeah.
you don't want to do it while you're driving. Yeah. Obviously.
Yeah.
In the middle of certain things.
Yeah, but you'd probably pull your car over and go get a cup of coffee or something.
I would take a nap myself.
Take a nap. Yeah, but that's right. The thing is that you're recognizing something, you know, qualities of mind is being brought about by gunas. It gives you a certain freedom. It gives you a certain freedom from those qualities of mind.
But I mean,
because
they're
you
still there.
Them.
It's not. It's,
yes, they're still there.
They don't
there.
Overwhelm you and they don't grab you, but
they're still there.
They're still there.
That's right, and they will go on changing. They won't be there forever because there's this continual play of these three gunas. You see what I mean?
Yes.
Like, yeah. And you can also facilitate their changing if it's something that you don't want or is causing you pain. Especially when you gain self-knowledge, because then you can pull this delusional thinking back, or you can, if the desires are getting out of control, you know, or your mind is getting agitated, you can pull it back.
And
because there's an ananda there of your own being.
And who do you, what should you, how to say this? What would you say, who owns that kind of mind? Or who's in control of that? Or how do you explain that when it does that? I mean,
when it does what?
Well, say it gets lost in Rajas or something. And who's responsible for that? Is it just the Prakriti?
Prakriti. You can say, yeah, it's Prakriti. In the end, it's Prakriti.
Really?
Yeah. But there's a lot of cause and effect that are taking place that go back infinitely, that are creating the situation that you find yourself in. You know? In the end, that's the truth of it, because yeah. yourself is not doing anything. The Atma is not doing anything.
Yeah. So it's, you're not at fault then with this play of these gunas?
You're not at fault with the play of the gunas, but the thing is that you can get involved in a dharma and all of these kind of things that can cause a lot of pain. You know? And so once you realize, once the mind realizes that, it can take different type of way of being with those to mitigate kind of the cause-effect, snowball effect. So there's things that you can do. Mm-hmm. You know, but whatever is happening are still all of the gunas at play. Mm-hmm. The Atma's not doing anything.
Mm-hmm. Because the thing, the psychological order that could be sattvic, right?
Yes. It can be sattvic, but see, when the buddhi acknowledges the tamas or rajas, the buddhi becomes sattvic.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? Because that creates a predominance. It can create a predominance of sattva when you objectify the tamas or rajas. Because then the sattva becomes in control, in a sense. And then the sattva buddhi can take action, come into relationship with the tamas in a way that is helpful. It can become in relationship with the rajas in a way that is helpful.
Would there ever be a place of maturity where you could go like, oh, this is the prakriti of tamas right now?
Yes, definitely.
Just finished.
Yeah.
No analysis. No.
Yeah, you don't need any analysis because it's all clear.
That's a maturity, though.
Yeah.
You know, you were just talking about something, and earlier you were talking about it too. There's a preference for sattva in a certain way, but my sense is that wouldn't be a universal always kind of preference. You wouldn't want to always be sattvic. I mean, you want to sleep at night, you know. You need to get things done. So sometimes the other gunas would be more appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, but
I'm
you
just
don't
kind
want
of wondering
the,
what's
say
the,
if you have with tamas is useful at night when you're going to sleep. But in the waking state, tamas isn't always very desirable. You know, because you don't have any energy, you don't feel like doing anything, you can't make a decision, so you just feel, you know, lazy and dull and but say if you have knowledge, you would probably just say, oh, I'm really tired and lazy and dull right now. It's not a big deal. But if you're always tired and lazy and dull and slothful, it's like your mind has got caught and that you have no way to get out of it. And maybe all of the food you eat and the lifestyle that you have is becoming more and more tamasic. We'll get into that, I think, in chapter 16. The different kinds of food that are tamasic, the different types of lifestyle that are tamasic or rajasic, that, you know, kind of put cause by cause effect, keep those gunas active in a way that you wouldn't choose. So there's lifestyle and food and a lot of various different things that excite one guna or another. And say you would like to be predominantly sattva so that you can study, so that you can gain this knowledge. You know, there's certain foods you should avoid. There's certain lifestyles you should avoid. You should get enough sleep, but not too much sleep. You should eat to such a degree that one quarter of your stomach is always empty, so that you don't overeat, because that makes you tamasic. They go into all of this in the...
But then it becomes the Ayurvedic whole thing, right?
Well, Ayurveda, Ayurveda and all of this is all tied in.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's all the same shastra. But you get certain general understandings and general rules to help you be more sattvic or less rajasic or less tamasic. But you can take this to any length, and then you become or an Ayurvedic doctor, and everything's about the food that you eat, that type of thing. All really they're trying to do in the Bhagavad Gita here, or in the Upanishads, is to help you to identify Maya, the sattva, rajas, and tamas, to have some sort of ability to objectify your experiences and to categorize them in a way that is helpful, all for the sake of viveka, so that you more in all of these, they're just devices to help you to differentiate your being from the experiences that you have. This is just one way of helping you to do this differentiation. Because in the end, no matter what experience that you're having, yourself is pervasive to and changeless in that experience. So the Shastra goes through a myriad of different logics and experiential analysis with all different types of things. Now we're in the Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, just to help you objectify your experience and recognize yourself and to objectify your experience. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting, actually, if you just sit with it for a while to try to understand it. I like in Vedanta and the Shastra, I like to really sit with everything they have to say to understand it, because it all has some meaning, some purpose.
It's all relevant, then.
It's relevant, yeah. You have to see what they're trying to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not just making it up. They're actually talking about sattva, rajas, and tamas.
So the Shastra doesn't theorize or...
It's not theorizing, it's descriptive. Sattva, rajas, and tamas is there. It's a way of categorizing experience. Those are valid ways of categorizing your experience. You know? Just like dividing the universe up into five elements. You can divide it up in many, many ways. Right? So many ways. There's so many different paradigms or grids you can put on the universe, but you put a particular paradigm onto the universe because it's helpful for what you're trying to study, what you're trying to learn or accomplish or see.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Vedanta has different grids or paradigms or ways of dividing up the creation in a way that is helpful for you to differentiate your being from the objectifiable experiences that come and go. You know? So it's not making up sattva, rajas, and tamas. It is using these as three categories, ways of dividing your experience.
So every experience fits into one of those mouths?
Mm-hmm. They do, yeah. But, you know, I could have another set which every experience could fit into. It's just these three are accomplishing a purpose. Right?
When you mentioned that the buddhi can recognize which guna is predominant, and then that's really useful.
Yeah.
And then also...
Because in that recognition, there's also the subject-object. Right? When the
Then you objectify the guna, and it's no longer...
Holding you.
You're not identified with it.
Yeah, exactly.
And is it a similar process when you recognize the moha? Or it's some kind of, maybe I'm getting mixed up with the words here, but the complex, you're caught up in a complex. You were talking about like when there's a thought that's at the center and then it just generates this whole fury of, you know, more thoughts, and it goes on and on.
Yeah, you know, when this mohana or moha, both are correct, moha or mohana, when that is there, the experience, you're surrounded by the experience. So whatever subject-object that is happening there is happening within the experience. So it's as though the ego or the conscious buddhi has been swallowed by the experience and is only experiencing within it. And that's why I said, you know, when that mohana is there, it will pass. And when it passes, you're going to feel, well, wow, that's so amazing. That was so completely real. But what I really believed it fully, and now I see that that wasn't true. It's astounding. Okay, so what all you can do when this delusion is up is you can have a little tiny squeaky voice that will say, I know for sure that this is true. I don't have any doubt about it. But maybe it isn't. That's when moha is taking place, that's the best you can do. I know this is absolutely, absolutely true, and I really don't have any doubt about it, but it may not be true. That's moha.
So,
and most people, you have to be very skilled to even be able to bring in that little voice, because if the mohana is there, that voice is very hard to generate. Because the mohana is so strong that when that little voice comes, the moha will say, "Oh, get out." There you go again. Get out of here. You know? So it takes some experience. And after some time of working on yourself and doing inner child work, that type of mohana, you're not so...
Right,
subject
to. Is that what
to.
You mean when you say sometimes, you know, you come to class and you have a clean slate?
Yeah, it means the mind, yeah, the mind that's sattva.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just really simple. Yeah. Projection is amazing. Projection, when a person is projecting, that is their reality. Even though it isn't, it's the snake on the rope.
For me, one of the ones that really comes up a lot is like, so-and-so is a jerk, in one form or another, whoever it is. And a question came up for me while you were talking about this earlier. If I'm thinking that so-and-so did something wrong, whoever it is that always indicative of a moha being happening, or is it maybe sometimes they really are a jerk? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, sometimes they people really are a jerk, but we have to look at your reaction. So say the person is a jerk, okay?
Yeah.
But all that you notice is that their behavior is inappropriate. It hasn't triggered some huge monster inside of you. If it's triggered a huge reaction inside of you, just think, a lot of people are jerks, or they're doing inappropriate actions, or have done a criminal behavior and all of this kind of stuff, but it doesn't generate anything in you. It's just an objective fact, right? It hasn't all this emotional turmoil hasn't happened at all. So when a person's behavior creates in you all this emotional turmoil, that behavior is a trigger for something in you. And you just have to look at what it is. And usually it'll be something like this. Some sort of dyad is inside that you find yourself on either side of. Like, for instance, say you had a highly abusive father. There's going to be a dyad now between you, the little child, innocent victim, child, and the perpetrator father, mean, nasty father. That dyad is inside. When the dyad is inside, that means both are inside, the mean father and the innocent child. Okay?
Oh.
Both are there inside, not just one.
He's come in.
So now what that means is that sometimes you will be identified with the mean father and you'll be mean to the little victim child. Sometimes you'll be the victim child and you'll see the other as the mean father. So that's the dyad, the projection is taking place. What's projected is either the innocent child or the mean father. Do you see what I mean? Either one is going to be projected, and you're going to be playing the other part. And that seems completely real. I'm the victim, you know, and that person is so mean, or I find myself being very mean to that other person that is just a weak victim there. And in that case, I have now been overwhelmed by the perpetrator. And as the perpetrator, I hate and am disgusted with the victim. And that's why I'm abusing the victim.
And he deserves it.
All of that. And your self-righteous fury and all of that, because that is what has been internalized. But sometimes the other person is the mean, is the perpetrator, and I am the one suffering hurt, little child. These are what complexes are. They're usually always in a dyad form. So father, child, mother, child. It can even be in siblings. If it's taking place young, say you have a difficult relationship with a sibling. These dyads usually take place in you at a young age. Well, because once you're a little older, then the mind can handle it a little better, so it doesn't all just get swallowed into the unconscious.
Are there projections when the dyad is benevolent?
Yeah, but those we like. Those aren't causing problems, because say, for instance, your parental figure, teachers or whatnot, were very, very loving and supportive of you, then that is internalized. But then in that way, you work very well socially with others. Right? There's no problem because that dyad is benign. You see the good in the person, right? You see the good in the person, or you always take the person to be seeing the good in you. Because this other thing isn't in there. So that's a positive. Yeah. And kind of goes along with nature, whereas the abusive things kind of step outside of what is natural or normal. They become more in the realm of adharma, and they cause a lot of pain. Dharma doesn't cause pain. You know, dharma, you relax in dharma, because dharma means order. Everything is in order. Adharma means it's going out of order, and then the universe is going to resist and push it back. And that hurts, you know. The universe is a great teacher, because when you're going outside of dharma, it's going to shove you back.
So the lack of social skills and that kind of thing that comes up is often, maybe always, but often at least, because there's a delusional projection, some kind of dyadic, or maybe other, maybe there's more than just two, but...
Well, I'm using delusional kind of in the Vedanta world as moha, but you can just say complexes.
A complex. Mm-hmm. So there's some complex in operation. And
most likely.
Most likely. And because if the complex wasn't there, we would be able to see more clearly and, you know, see the person for who they are and interact in a more skillful way. Is that...
I would say that that's true. You wouldn't have the negative bent. What causes the negative bent is pain.
The pressure.
The pressure, yeah. And pain. You know? When you're not
the pain causes the pressure.
The pain causes
in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. When you're not in pain, you know, that's not what's being projected. When you're not in pain, then everybody's fine. It's no problem. Why don't we stop here?